Her Vespa was at the curb, the Vespa she had used some days ago to motor up to Harold Lauder's house. Why had she gone there? She hadn't passed a dozen words with Harold since she'd gotten to Boulder. But in her confusion about the planchette, and in her terror of the dreams that continued to come to her even after everyone else's had stopped, it had seemed to her that she must talk about it to Harold. She had been afraid of that impulse, too. It seemed to be an idea that had come to her from outside herself. His thought, maybe. But when she had given in and gone to Harold's, he hadn't been at home. The house was locked, the only locked house she had come upon in Boulder, and the shades were drawn. She had rather liked that, and she'd had a moment's bitter disappointment that Harold was not there. If he had been, he could have let her in and then locked the door behind her. They could have gone into the living room and talked, or made love, or have done unspeakable things together, and no one would have known. Harold's was a private place. "What's happening to me?" she whispered to the dark, but the dark had no answer for her. She started the Vespa, and the steady burping pop of its engine seemed to profane the night. She put it in gear and drove away, to the west. Moving, the cool night air on her face, she felt better at last. Blow away the cobwebs, night wind. You know, don't you? When all the choices but one have been taken away, what do? You choose what's left. You choose whatever dark adventure was meant for you. You let Larry have his stupid little twist of tail with her tight pants and her single-syllable vocabulary and her movie magazine mind. You go beyond them. You risk whatever there is to be risked. The road unrolled before her in the baby spotlight of the Vespa's headlamp. She had to switch to second gear as the road began to climb. She was on Baseline Road now, heading up the Black Mountain. Let them have their meetings. They were concerned with getting the power back on. Her lover was concerned with the world. The Vespa's engine lugged and strained and somehow carried on. A horrible yet sexy kind of fear began to grip her, and the vibrating saddle of the motorbike began to heat her up down there. "Why, you're horny, Nadine," she thought with shrill good humor. "Naughty, naughty, naughty." To her right was a straight drop-off. Nothing but death down there. And up above? Well, she would see. It was too late to turn back, and that thought alone made her feel paradoxically and deliciously free. An hour later, she was in Sunrise Amphitheater, but Sunrise was still 3 or more hours away. The amphitheater was close to the summit of Flagstaff Mountain, and nearly everyone in the free zone had made the trip to the camping area at the top before they had been in Boulder very long. On a clear day, which was most days in Boulder, at least during the summer season, you could see Boulder and I-25 stretching away south to Denver and then off into the haze toward New Mexico, 200 miles beyond. Due east were the flatlands, stretching away toward Nebraska, and closer at hand was Boulder Canyon, a knife gash through foothills that were walled in pine and spruce. In summers gone by, gliders had plied the thermals over Sunrise Amphitheater like birds. Now Nadine saw only what was revealed in the glow of the 6-cell flashlight which she put on a picnic table near the drop-off. There was a large artist's sketch pad turned back to a clean sheet, and squatting on it the 3-cornered planchette like a triangular spider. Protruding from its belly like a spider's stinger was a pencil, lightly touching the pad. Nadine was in a feverish state that was half euphoria, half terror. Coming up here on the back of her gamely laboring Vespa, which had most decidedly not been made for mountain climbing, she had felt what Harold had felt in Nederland. She could feel him. But while Harold had felt it as a sort of magnetism, a drawing toward, Nadine felt it as a kind of mystic event, a border crossing. It was as if these mountains, of which she was even now only in the foothills, were a no-man's land between 2 spheres of influence. Flag in the west, the old woman in the east. And here the magic flew both ways, mixing, making its own concoction that belonged neither to God nor to Satan, but which was totally pagan. She felt she was in a haunted place. And the planchette. She had tossed the brightly marked box, stamped Made in Taiwan, away indifferently for the wind to take. The planchette itself was only a poorly stamped piece of fiberboard or gypsum, but it didn't matter. It was a tool she would use only once, only dared to use once. And even a poorly made tool can serve its purpose. To break open a door, to close a window, to write a name. The words on the box recurred. Amaze your friends. Brighten up your get-togethers. What was that song Larry sometimes bellowed from the seat of his Honda as they rode along? Hello, Central. What's the matter with your line? I want to talk to... Talk to who? But that was the question, wasn't it? Her heart beating loudly, Nadine sat down on the picnic bench and pressed her fingers lightly to two of the planchette's three sides. She could feel it begin to move under the balls of her fingers almost immediately, and she thought of a car with its engine idling. But who was the driver? Who was he really? Who would climb in and slam the door and put his sun-blackened hands on the wheel? Whose foot, brutal and heavy, shod in an old and dusty cowboy boot, would come down on the accelerator and take her? Where? Driver, where are you taking us? Nadine, beyond help or hope of succor, sat upright on the bench at the crest of Flagstaff Mountain in the black trench of morning, her eyes wide, that feeling of being on the border stronger than ever. She felt his dark presence coming in waves. Somewhere, Flag was abroad in the night, and she spoke two words like an incantation to all the black spirits that had ever been. Incantation and invitation. Tell me. And beneath her fingers, the planchette began to write. Chapter 44. Excerpts from the minutes of the Permanent Free Zone Committee meeting, August 19, 1980. This meeting was held at the apartment of Stu Redman and Fran Goldsmith. All members of the Free Zone Committee were present. Stu Redman offered congratulations to all of us, including himself, on being elected to the Permanent Committee. He made a motion that a letter of thanks to Harold Lauder be drafted and signed by each member of the committee. The second item of business was our scouts in the West. To recap, the committee has decided to ask Judge Ferris, Tom Cullen, and Dana Jurgens to go. Stu suggested that the people who nominated each of them be the ones to broach the subject to their own nominees. That is, Larry Underwood asks the judge, Nick will have to talk to Tom, with Ralph Brentner's help, and Sue will talk to Dana. Nick said that working with Tom might take a few days, and Stu said that brought up the point of when to send them. Larry said they couldn't be sent together or they might all get caught together. He went on to say that both the judge and Dana would probably suspect that we had sent more than one spy, but as long as they didn't know the actual names, they couldn't tattle. Fran said that tattle was hardly the word, considering what that man in the West might do to them, if he is a man. Glenn suggested that we agree tentatively to this schedule. The judge would go out on August 26th, Dana on the 27th, and Tom on the 28th, none of them to know about the others, and each to leave on a different road. Nick added that, with the exception of Tom Cullen, who will be told when to come back by means of a post-hypnotic suggestion, the other two must be told to come back when their own discretion advises them to, but that the weather could become a factor. There can be heavy snow in the mountains by the first week of October. Nick suggested that each of them should be advised to spend no more than 3 weeks in the West. Fran said they could swing around to the south if the snow came early in the mountains, but Larry disagreed, pointing out that the Sangre de Cristo chain would be in the way unless they swung all the way down to Mexico. And if they had to do that, we probably wouldn't see them again until spring. Larry said if that was the case, perhaps we ought to give the judge a head start. He suggested August 21st, day after tomorrow. That closed the subject of the scouts, or spies if you prefer. Glenn was then recognized, and I am now quoting from the taped record. Glenn, I want to move that we call another public meeting on August 25th, and I'm going to suggest a few things that we might cover at that meeting. I'd like to start by pointing out something that may surprise you. We've been assuming that we've got about 600 people in the zone, and Ralph has kept admirable, accurate records of the number of large groups that have come in, and we've based our population assumption on those figures. But there have also been people coming in by dribs and drabs, maybe as many as 10 a day. So earlier today, I went over to the Chautauqua Park Auditorium with Leo Rockway, and we counted the seats in the hall. There are 607 of them. Now, does that tell you anything? Sue Stern said that couldn't be right because people had been standing in the back and sitting in the aisles when they couldn't get seats. Then we all saw what Glenn was getting at, and I guess it would be appropriate to say the committee was thunderstruck. Glenn, we don't have any way of accurately estimating how many standees and sitties we had, but I'd think 100 would be a terribly conservative estimate. So you see, we really have better than 700 people here in the zone. Fran Goldsmith then made a motion that the committee put a census committee on the agenda for the meeting on August 25th, said committee to be responsible for keeping a roll of every Free Zone member. It was voted 7-0 to put the census committee on the agenda of the next public meeting. Stu then moved that we hold the meeting on August 25th in Munsinger Auditorium at CU, which has a bigger capacity, probably over 1,000. Glenn then asked for and received the floor again. Glenn, there's another point to be made for the census committee that you're overlooking. We should know who's coming in, but we should also know who is leaving. I think people are, you know. Maybe it's just paranoia, but I could swear that there have been faces I've gotten used to seeing that just aren't around anymore. Anyhow, after we went out to the Chautauqua Auditorium, Leo and I went over to Charlie Impening's house. And guess what? The house is empty, Charlie's things are gone, and so is Charlie's BSA. Some uproar from the committee, also profanity, which, while colorful, does not have any place in this record. Ralph then asked what good it would do for us to know who is leaving. He suggested that if people like Impening wanted to go over to the Dark Man, then we should look at it as a case of good riddance. Several of the committee applauded Ralph, who blushed like a schoolboy, if I may add that. Sue. No, I see Glenn's point. It would be like a constant drain of information. Ralph. Well, what could we do? Put them in jail? Glenn. Ugly as it sounds, I think we have to consider that very strongly. Fran. No, sir. Sending spies, I can stomach that. But locking up people who come here because they don't like the way we're doing things? Jesus, Glenn, that's secret police stuff. Glenn. Yes, that's about what it comes down to. But our position here is extremely precarious. You're putting me in the position of having to advocate repression, and I think that's very unfair. I'm asking you if you want to allow a brain drain to go on in light of our adversary. Are you prepared to take the chance? Do you want him to know our strength of numbers and how we're getting along on the technical side? That we don't even have a doctor yet? Fran said she'd rather have it that way than start locking people up because they didn't like the way we were running things. Stu then motioned that we table the whole idea of locking people up for contrary views. This motion was passed with Glenn voting against. Glenn, you better get used to the idea that you're going to have to deal with this sooner or later, and more sooner than later. Charlie Impening may be spilling his guts to flag himself in 2 weeks' time, and not all the good intentions in the universe will put a stop to that. Well, never mind, you voted a table. But there's another thing. We're elected indefinitely. Did any of you think of that? We don't know if we're serving 6 weeks, 6 months, or 6 years. My suggestion would be 1 year. That ought to take us to the end of the beginning, in Harold's phrase. I'd like to see the one-year thing on the agenda for our next public meeting. One last item, and I'm done. Government by town meeting, which is essentially what we have, with ourselves as town selectmen, is going to be fine for a while, until we've got about 3,000 people or so. But when things get too big, most of the people who show up at the public meetings are going to be cliques and folks with axes to grind. Fluoridation makes you sterile, people who want one sort of flag, things like that. My suggestion would be that we all think very hard about how to turn Boulder into a republic by late next winter or early spring. There was some informal discussion of Glenn's last proposal, but no action was taken at this meeting. Nick was recognized and gave Ralph something to read. Nick, I'd like to see this go on the agenda for our next public meeting. to see if the Free Zone will create a Department of Law and Order with Stu Redman as its head. Stu, that's a hell of a thing to spring on me, Nick. Nick, he would have the power to deputize men on his own up to 30 and over 30 on a majority vote of the Free Zone in public session. That's the resolution I'd like to see on the next agenda. Of course, we can approve until we're black in the face, and it will do no good unless Stu goes along. Stu, damn right. Nick, we've gotten big enough to really need some law. Things are going to get flaky without it. There's the case of the Geringer boy racing that fast car up and down Pearl Street. He finally crashed it and was lucky to walk away with nothing worse than a gash on his forehead. He could have killed himself or someone else. Now, everybody who saw him doing that knew it was nothing but trouble. M-O-O-N, that spells trouble, as Tom would say. But nobody felt they could stop him, because they just didn't have the authority. That's one thing. Then there's Rich Moffat. Probably some of you know who Rich is, but for those of you who don't, he's probably the zone's only practicing alcoholic. He's a half-decent guy when he's sober, but when he's drunk, he's just not accountable for what he does, and he spends a lot of time drunk. 3 or 4 days ago, he got a load on and decided he was going to break every plate glass window on Pearl Street. Now, I talked to him about that after he sobered off a little, and he was pretty ashamed. And he pointed back the way he had come and said, "Look at that. Look what I done. Glass all over the sidewalk. What if some kid gets hurt in that? I'll be to blame." Ralph, I got no sympathy. None. Fran, come on, Ralph. Everybody knows alcoholism's a disease. Ralph, disease my ass, it's getting sloppo, that's what it is. Stu got the meeting back in order, finally. Nick, to make a long story short, I found Rich a broom and he swept up most of the mess he'd made. Did a pretty good job, too. But he was right to ask why someone didn't stop him. In the old days, a guy like Rich couldn't even get all the high-tension booze he wanted. Guys like Rich were just winos. But now there are incredible amounts of booze just waiting around to be lifted off the shelves. And furthermore, I really do believe that Rich never should have been allowed to get past his second window, but he broke every window on the south side of the street for 3 blocks. He finally stopped because he got tired. Then we had a case where a man whose name I won't mention found out that his woman, who I also won't name, was spending her afternoon sack time with a third party. I guess we all know who I'm talking about. Sue. Yeah, I guess we do. Big man with his fists. Nick. Anyway, the man in question beat up the third party and then the woman in the case. Now, I don't think it matters to any of us here who was right and who was wrong. What matters is that the man in question committed a felony crime, assault and battery, and he's walking around free. Of the 3 cases, this one worries ordinary citizens the most. We've got a melting pot society, a real hodgepodge, and there are going to be all kinds of conflicts and abrasions. I don't think any of us want a frontier society here in Boulder. Think of the situation we'd have if the man in question had gotten a .45 out of a pawn shop and then shot them both dead instead of just beating them up. Then we'd have a murderer walking around free. Stu's already our public and private moderator, which means people already see him as an authority figure. And personally, I think Stu is a good man. Stu. All right, I'll accept the nomination if that's what you want. I don't really want the goddamn job. From what I've seen down in Texas, police work is mostly cleaning puke off your shirt when guys like Rich Moffat barf on you, or scraping dummies like that Geringer boy off the roads. All I ask is that when we put it up on the public meeting, we set the same 1-year time limit on it that we're setting on our committee jobs, and I intend to make it clear that I'm stepping down at the end of that year. If that's acceptable, okay. Stu then called the question and asked if there was any further discussion. Fran. Yes, there's some discussion. I have a question. What if somebody blows your head off? Stu. I don't think... Fran. No, you don't think. You don't think so. Well, what's Nick going to tell me if what you all think is wrong? Oh, I'm sorry, Fran. Is that what he's going to say? Your man is down in the county courthouse with a bullet hole in his head, and I guess we've made a mistake? Jesus, Mary and Joseph, I'm going to have a baby, and you people want him to be Pat Garrett. There was another 10 minutes of discussion, most of which is irrelevant, and Fran, your obedient recording secretary, had herself a good cry and then got herself under control. The vote on nominating Stu to be Free Zone Marshal was 6-1, and this time Fran would not change her vote. Glenn asked to be recognized for one last thing before we closed the meeting. Glenn. This is middle think again, not a motion, nothing to vote on, but something we ought to chew over. Going back to Nick's third example of law and order problems, he described the case and finished by saying we didn't have to be concerned with who was right and who was wrong. I think he was mistaken. I believe Stu is one of the fairest men I've ever met. But law enforcement without a courts system isn't justice. It's just vigilantism, rule by the fist. Now, suppose that fellow we all know had gotten a 45 and had killed his woman and her lover. And further, suppose that Stu, as our marshal, went out and collared him and put him in the calaboose. Then what? How long do we keep him there? Legally, we couldn't keep him at all, at least according to the Constitution we adopted at our meeting last night, because under that document, a man's innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Now, as a matter of fact, we all know we'd keep him locked up. We wouldn't feel safe with him walking the streets. So we do it even though it would be patently unconstitutional, because when safety and constitutionality are at sword's points, safety must win out. But it behooves us to make safety and constitutionality synonymous as quickly as we can. We need to think about a court system. Fran moved that the meeting be adjourned, and it was so voted, 7-0. Francis Goldsmith, secretary. Why are you stopping? Fran asked as Stu slowly biked over to the curb and put his feet down. It's a block further up. Her eyes were still red from her burst of tears during the meeting, and Stu thought he had never seen her look so tired. This Marshall thing, he began. Stu, I don't want to talk about it. Somebody has to do it, honey. And Nick was right, I'm the logical choice. Fuck logic. What about me and the baby? I ought to know what you want for the baby, he said softly. Haven't you told me enough times? You want him brought into a world that isn't totally crazy. You want things safe for him, or her. I want that, too. But I wasn't going to say that in front of the rest. It's between you and me. And you and the baby are the two main reasons I said okay. I know that, she said in a low, choked voice. He put his fingers under her chin and tilted her face up. He smiled at her, and she made an effort to smile back. It was a weary smile, and tears were coursing down her cheeks, but it was better than no smile at all. Everything's going to be fine, he said. She was shaking her head back and forth slowly, and some of her tears flew off into the warm summer night. I don't think so, she said. No, I really don't think it is. She lay awake long into the night, thinking that warmth can only come from a burning. Prometheus got his eyes pecked out on that one. And that love always comes due in blood. And a queer certainty stole over her, as numbing as some creeping anesthesia, that they would finish by wading in blood. The thought made her place her hands protectively over her belly, and she found herself thinking for the first time in weeks of her dream. The dark man with his grin and his twisted coat hanger. As well as hunting for Mother Abigail with a picked group of volunteers in his spare time, Harold Lauder was on the burial committee, and on August 21st, he spent the day in the back of a dump truck with five other men, all of them wearing boots and protective clothing and heavy-duty Playtex rubber gloves. The head of the burial committee, Chad Norris, was out at what he referred to as burial site number one, with an almost grisly calm. Number one was 10 miles southwest of Boulder in an area that had once been strip-mined for coal. It lay as bleak and barren as the mountains of the moon under the burning August sun. Chad had accepted the post reluctantly because he had once been an undertaker's assistant in Morristown, New Jersey. There's no undertaking about this, he had said this morning at the Greyhound bus terminal between Arapahoe and Walnut, that was the burial committee's base of operations. He lit a Winston with a wooden match and grinned at the 20 men sitting around. That is, it's an undertaking, but it's not an undertaking, if you get my meaning. There were a few strained smiles, Harold's largest among them. His belly had been rumbling constantly because he hadn't dared eat breakfast. He hadn't been sure he could keep it down, considering the nature of the work. He could have stuck with finding Mother Abigail, and no one would have murmured a word of protest, even though it had to be obvious to every thinking man in the zone that looking for her with 15 men was an exercise in comic relief when you considered the thousands of square miles of empty forest and plain around Boulder. And, of course, she might never have left Boulder. None of them seemed to have thought of that, which didn't surprise Harold at all. She could be set up in a house just about anywhere beyond the center of town, and they'd still never find her without a house-to-house search. Redman and Andros hadn't raised a word of protest between them when Harold suggested that the search committee be a weekend and evening sort of thing, which told Harold that they had accepted it as a closed case, too. He could have stuck with it, but who gets to be best liked in any community? Who is the most trusted? Why, the man who does the dirty job, of course, and does it with a smile. The man who does the job you couldn't bring yourself to do. It's going to be like burying cordwood, Chad told them. If you can keep it on that level in your mind, you'll be okay. Some of you may have to vomit here at the start. There's no shame in that. Just try to go someplace where the rest won't have to look at you do it. The men were eyeing each other uncomfortably. Chad broke them up into 3 6-man crews. He and the other two went out to prepare a place for those who were brought. Each of the three crews were given a specific area of town to work. Harold's truck had spent the day in the Table Mesa area, working their way slowly west from the Denver-Boulder Turnpike exit ramp, up Martin Drive to the Broadway intersection, down 39th Street, then back up 40th, suburban houses in a tract area now about 30 years old, dating back to the start of Boulder's population boom. Chad had provided gas masks from the local National Guard armory, but they didn't have to use them until after lunch. Lunch? What lunch? Harold's consisted of a can of Barry's apple pie filling. It was all he could bring himself to eat. When they entered the Church of Latter-day Saints on Lower Table Mesa Drive, they had come here, filled with the plague, and they had died there, over 70 of them, and the stink was enormous. Cordwood, one of Harold's mates had said in a high, revolted, laughing voice, and Harold had turned and stumbled out past him, and he went around the corner of the handsome brick building that had once been a polling place in election years, and up came the Barry's apple pie filling, and he discovered that Norris had been right. He really felt better without it. It took them 2 trips and most of the afternoon to empty the church. 20 men, Harold thought, to get rid of all the corpses in Boulder. It's almost funny. A goodly number of Boulder's previous population had run like rabbits because of the air testing center scare, but still. Harold supposed that as the burial committee grew with the population, it was just barely possible that they might get most of the bodies in the ground by the first heavy snowfall. Not that he himself expected to be around by then. And most of the people would never know how real the danger of some new epidemic, one they weren't immune to, had been. The Free Zone Committee was full of bright ideas, he thought with contempt. The committee would be just fine, as long as they had good old Harold Lauder to make sure their shoelaces were tied, of course. Good old Harold's good enough for that, but not quite good enough to serve on their fucking permanent committee. Heavens, no. He had never been quite good enough, not even quite good enough to get a date for the class dance at Agunquit High School, even with a skag. Good God, no, not Harold. Let's remember, folks, when we get right down to that proverbial place where the ursine mammal evacuated his bowels in the buckwheat, that this is no analytical, logical matter, not even a matter of common sense. When we get right down to it, what we end up with is a frigging beauty contest. Well, somebody remembers. Somebody is keeping score, kids. So he came back into the church, wiping his mouth and grinning as best he could, nodding that he was ready to go on. Someone clapped him on the back, and Harold's grin widened, and he thought, someday you're going to lose your hand for that shit heap. They made their last run at 4:15 p.m., the body of the dump truck filled with the last of the latter-day corpses. In town, the truck had to weave laboriously in and out of stalled traffic, but on Colorado 119, 3 tow trucks had been out all day, latching onto stalled cars and depositing them into the ditches on both sides of the road. They lay there like the overturned toys of some giant child. At the burial site, the other 2 orange trucks were already parked. Men stood around with their rubber gloves off, their fingers white and pruny at the tips from a day of sweating inside rubber. They smoked and talked desultorily. Most of them were very pale. Norris and his 2 helpers had it down to a science now. They shook out a huge piece of plastic sheeting on the rubbly ground. Norman Kellogg, the Louisianan who was driving Harold's truck, backed up to the edge of the plastic. The tailgate slammed down, and the first bodies fell out onto the plastic draw sheet like partially stiffened rag dolls. Harold wanted to turn away, but was afraid that the others might construe it as weakness. He did not mind watching them fall out too much. It was the sound they made when they hit what was going to become their shroud. The note of the dumper's engine deepened, and there was a hydraulic whine as the truck's body began to go up. Now the bodies tumbled out in a grotesque human rain. Harold felt an instant of pity, a feeling so deep it was an ache. Cordwood, he thought. How right he was. That's all that's left. Just cordwood. Ho! Chad Norris shouted, and Kellogg pulled the dump truck ahead and shut it off. Chad and his helpers stepped onto the plastic carrying rakes, and now Harold did turn away, pretending to scan the sky for rain, and he was not alone. But he heard a sound that would haunt him in his dreams, and that was the sound of change falling from the pockets of the dead men and women as Chad and his helpers worked with their rakes, spreading the corpses evenly. The coins falling on the plastic made a sound that reminded Harold absurdly of tiddlywinks. When he looked back, the three of them were pulling the edges of the plastic shroud together, grunting with the strain, arms bulging. A few of the other men, Harold among them, pitched in. Chad Norris produced a huge industrial stapling gun. 20 minutes later, that part of the job was done, and the plastic lay on the ground like a giant gelatin capsule. Norris climbed into the cab of a bright yellow bulldozer and keyed the engine. The scarred blade thudded down. The dozer rolled forward. A man named Wyzak, also on Harold's truck, walked away from the scene with the jerky steps of a badly controlled puppet. A cigarette jittered between his fingers. "Man, I can't watch that," he said as he passed Harold. "It's really kind of funny. I never knew I was Jewish until today." The bulldozer shoved and rolled the large plastic package into a long rectangular cut in the ground. Chad backed off, shut down, and climbed off. Motioning the men to gather around, he walked over to one of the public works trucks and put one booted foot up on the running board. "No football cheers," he said, "but you did damned good. We put away close to 1,000 units today, I guess." Units, Harold thought. "I know this kind of work takes something out of a man. The committee's promising us another 2 men before the end of the week, but I know that don't change the way you guys feel, or the way I feel, for that matter. All I'm saying is that if you've had enough, don't feel like you can take another day of it. You don't have to worry about avoiding me on the street. But if you feel like you can't cut it, it's awful damn important that you find someone to take your place tomorrow. So far as I'm concerned, this is the most important job in the zone. It isn't too bad now, but if we've still got 20,000 corpses in Boulder next month when it gets to be wet weather, people are going to get sick. If you feel like you can make it, I'll see you tomorrow morning at the bus station." "I'll be there," someone said. "Me too," Norman Kellogg said. "After a 6-hour bath tonight." There was laughter. "Count me in," Wyzak chimed in. "Me too," Harold said quietly. "It's a dirty job," Norris said in a low, emotional voice. "You're good men. The rest of them may never know just how good." Harold felt a sense of drawing together, a camaraderie, and he fought against it, suddenly afraid. This was no part of the plan. "See you tomorrow, Hawk," Wyzak said, and squeezed his shoulder. Harold's grin was startled and defensive. Hawk? What kind of joke was that? A bad one, of course. Cheap sarcasm, calling fat, pimply Harold Lauder Hawk. He felt the old black hate rise, directed at Wyzak this time, and then it subsided in sudden confusion. He wasn't fat anymore. He couldn't even properly be called stout. His pimples had vanished over the last 7 weeks. Wyzak didn't know he had once been a school joke. Wyzak didn't know that Harold's father had once asked him if he was a homosexual. Wyzak didn't know that Harold had been his popular sister's cross to bear. And if he had known, Wyzak probably wouldn't have given one leaf off the fig tree. Harold climbed into the back of one of the trucks, his mind churning helplessly. All of a sudden, the old grudges, the old hurts, and the unpaid debts seemed as worthless as the paper money choking all the cash registers of America. Could that be true? Could it possibly be true? He felt panicked, alone, scared. No, he decided at last, it couldn't possibly be true. Because consider, if you were strong-willed enough to be able to resist the low opinions of others, when they thought you were a queer or an embarrassment or just a plain old bag of shit, then you had to be strong-willed enough to resist... Resist what? Their good opinion of you? That was, well, lunacy, wasn't it? An old quote surfaced in his troubled mind, some general's defense of interning Japanese Americans during World War II. It had been pointed out to this general that no acts of sabotage had occurred on the West Coast, where the naturalized Japanese were most heavily concentrated. The general's reply had been, "The very fact that no sabotage has taken place is an ominous development." Their truck pulled into the bus station parking lot. Harold jumped over the side, reflecting that even his coordination had improved 1,000%, either from the weight he had lost, his almost constant exercise, or both. The thought came to him again, stubborn, refusing to be buried. I could be an asset to this community. But they had shut him out. That doesn't matter. I've got the brains to pick the lock on the door they slammed in my face, and I believe I've found enough guts to open it once it's unlocked. But stop it, stop it. You might as well be wearing handcuffs and leg chains with that one word stamped all over them. But. Hey, man, you okay? Harold jumped. It was Norris coming out of the dispatcher's office, which he had taken over. He looked tired. Me? I'm fine. I was just thinking. Well, you go right along. Seems like every time you do that, you coin money for this joint. Harold shook his head. Not true. No? Chad let it go. Can I drop you somewhere? Uh-uh. I've got my chopper. You want to know something, Hawk? I think most of these guys are really going to come back tomorrow. Yes, so do I. Harold walked over to his motorcycle and climbed on, savoring his new nickname, rather against his will. Nora shook his head. I never would have believed it. I'll see you tomorrow, man. 8, Harold confirmed, and drove out Arapaho to Broadway. To his right, a crew comprised mostly of women was at work with a wrecker and a derrick, riding a tractor-trailer truck that had jackknifed, partially blocking the street. They had drawn a respectable little crowd. This place is building up, Harold thought. I don't recognize half of those people. He went on out toward his house, his mind worrying and gnawing at the problem he thought he had solved long ago. When he got home, there was a small white Vespa parked at the curb, and a woman sitting on his front step. She stood up as Harold came up the walk and put her hand out. She was one of the most striking women Harold had ever seen. He had seen her before, of course, but rarely this close up. I'm Nadine Cross, she said. Her voice was low, close to being husky. Her grip was firm and cool. Harold's eyes dropped involuntarily to her body for a moment, a habit he knew girls hated, but one he seemed powerless to stop. This one did not seem to mind. She was wearing a pair of light cotton twill slacks that clung to her long legs and a sleeveless blouse of some light blue silky material. No bra, he guessed. How old was she? 30? 35? Younger, maybe. She was going prematurely gray. All over? The endlessly horny and endlessly virginal, seemingly, part of his mind inquired, and his heart beat a little faster. Harold Lauder, he said, smiling. You came in with Larry Underwood's party, didn't you? Yes, that's right. Larry came to see me last week, brought me a bottle of wine and some candy bars. His words had a tinkling, false sound to them, and he was suddenly sure that she knew he had been cataloging her, undressing her in his mind. He fought an urge to lick his lips and won, at least temporarily. He's a hell of a nice guy. Larry? She laughed a little, a strange and somehow cryptic sound. Yes, he's very nice. Larry's a prince. They gazed at each other for a moment, and Harold had never been looked at by a woman whose eyes were so frank and speculative. He was again aware of his excitement and a warm nervousness in his belly. "Well," he said, "what can I do for you this afternoon, Miss Cross? You could call me Nadine, for a start, and you could invite me to stay for supper. That would get us a little further along." That sense of nervous excitement began to spread. "Nadine, would you like to stay for supper?" "Very much," she said, and smiled. When she laid her hand on his forearm, he felt a tingle like a low-grade electric shock. Her eyes never left his. "Thank you." He fumbled his latchkey into its slot, thinking, "Now she'll ask me why I lock my door, and I'll mumble and stumble around looking for an answer and seem like a fool." But Nadine never asked. He didn't cook dinner. She did. Harold had gotten to the point where he considered it impossible to get even a half-decent meal out of cans, but Nadine managed nicely. Suddenly aware of and appalled by what he had spent his day doing, he asked if she could entertain herself for 20 minutes, and she was probably here on some very mundane piece of business, he cautioned himself desperately, while he cleaned up. When he came back, having splurged and taken a 2-bucket shower, she was bustling around in the kitchen. Water was boiling merrily away on the bottled gas stove. As he came into the kitchen, she dumped half a cup of elbow macaroni into the pot. Something mellow was being simmered in a skillet on the other burner. He got a combined aroma of French onion soup, red wine, and mushrooms. His stomach rumbled. The day's work just passed, all of a sudden, had lost its power over his appetite. "It smells fantastic," he said. "You shouldn't have, but I'm not complaining." "It's a stroganoff casserole," she said, turning to smile at him. "Tinned beef, I'm afraid. Not one of the recommended ingredients, but..." She shrugged to indicate the limitations they all labored under. "It's nice of you to do it." "Not at all." She gave him that speculative glance again and turned halfway toward him, the silky material of her blouse pulled taut against her left breast, molding it sweetly. He felt a hot flush creeping up his neck and willed himself not to have an erection. "We're going to be very good friends," she said. "We are?" "Yes." She turned back to the stove, seeming to close the subject, leaving Harold in a thicket of possibilities. Once, halfway through the meal, he tried again to ask her what had brought her here, but she only smiled and shook her head. "I like to see a man eat." For a moment, Harold thought she must be talking about someone else, and then realized she meant him. And he did eat. He had 3 helpings of the stroganoff, and the tinned meat did not detract from the recipe at all, in Harold's opinion. The conversation seemed to make itself, leaving him free to quiet the lion in his belly and to look at her. Striking, had he thought. She was beautiful. Her hair, which she had pulled back into a casual horsetail in order to cook more easily, was twisted with strands of pure white, not gray as he had first thought. Her eyes were grave and dark, and when they focused unhesitatingly on his, Harold felt giddy. Her voice was low and confidential. The sound of it began to affect him in a way that was both uncomfortable and almost excruciatingly pleasant.